This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hi, Katie.
It is almost the end of 2022. Hollywood is on vacation already, as far as we understand. And we're gathering for one last roundtable conversation for the year. And helping us are you guys, the listeners. You answered our call for some mailbag questions with, burning questions about this year's Oscar race and Oscar races past. It's a really great mix of questions. So we'll be diving into those. And then in the back half of the episode, a rare Thursday interview, I talked to Michael Barker and Tom Bernard, who have been the co-presidents of Sony Pictures Classics, founded it way back in 1992, and they have a new box set of some hits from the 30 years that they've been running the studio, which includes everything from SLC Punk to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon to Call Me By Your Name. And we talked about kind of the history of the studio and also their current Oscar race, including Living with Bill Nighy, who you heard David talk to earlier this week. So you'll hear more about that later. But first, let's open up the mailbag. Richard, you did the honors of kind of compiling all of these answers. How smart are our listeners?
Oh, they're great. And they have really interesting questions and provocative ones, you know, like where I got me thinking like about Oscar past and all that. So it was fun. We should do this more often.
Yeah. You can always email us at littlegoldmen@vf.com because we love hearing your questions on a regular basis. But yes, mailbag episodes. A special occasion we can bring back. Richard, do you want to do the honors of setting up our first email? It's a little long, so maybe we won't read it in full, but let's go to Rory.
So Rory writes, only twice since the 1930s have there been zero British acting nominees at the Oscars, at the 28th ceremony in 1956 and the 58th in 1986. And Rory says, I think we might be heading for the first Britless Oscar in 37 years. And then he goes down to break, there's obviously Olivia Colman for Empire of Light, Bill Nighy for Living, which I don't know, maybe we think that's the best bet. But then there's a lot of Irish folks, which does not count, obviously mm-hmm. It's a different country, like Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal and other people. But like otherwise, like Eddie Redmayne, Emma Thompson, those British campaigns didn't really materialize. So Rory is just wanting us to comment on that possibility.
The listeners are so smart. Like, I wouldn't even have noticed this coming, but it's such a good point. But I'm sure we can dig more into it. But I think we don't have to worry about this. I feel pretty okay with Bill Nighy. The last couple weeks especially, it just feels like so many people have been talking about Living. I think maybe a month ago I would have been a little more doubtful, but it does feel like he has a lot of momentum.
Are you saying, Rebecca, that Sony Pictures Classics
has
their way? Not that we're plugging them or anything.
You'll hear more about it later in this episode.
But yes, I do think that Bill Nighy is looking really good, and I am firmly on that train. I would be shocked if he doesn't make the final five.
In your interview with him, David, I think he kind of expressed kind of the shock at the grand tour he's been led on in terms of promoting the movie. And I talked to Barker Bernard about this, too, about kind of convincing people like that it's really worth it. But that's the secret sauce that they keep pulling off. And, Bill Nighy, I don't know if his Britishness is what helps him here, but being a beloved character actor, many of whom tend to be British, I think is really his ace up his sleeve in this race.
This is one case, too, where we'd been talking about the race for best actor being a little thin or disparate. And when I watched Living, he's just so good in it. And he's so affecting and lovable in an improbable way that the world does not make sense to me if he does not make the cut in this particular race, because he, first of all, scratches, I think, a particular itch. You have a couple actors in this field going for their first nominations after being in this industry for a long time, like Brendan Fraser, Colin Farrell. But he's especially a veteran, let's say. He's been acting for a long time. He's never been Oscar nominated. He's never even really been in contention. And so this is a real moment for him. And yeah, to Rebecca's point, the momentum is very clear. So I don't see that reversing.
Rory also was a little bit skeptical about women talking. I mean, Claire Foy and Jessie Buckley are Jessie Buckley is Irish, Claire Foy is British, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
But Buckley has the edge there. And then he writes, and if they can't get nominated for those, then there's not a lot of hope for Ben Whishaw, which I kind of think, bizarrely, for a movie called Women Talking, he might be the strongest contender just because supporting actor is weird this year. So that could be another Brit, but it is on the sort of positive side, it is interesting that so many Irish actors are in contention. I believe Rory counts it as being like six-ish people.
Wow. And none of them are Saoirse Ronan, which based on recent Oscar trends is unlikely.
I don't know. There could be a late breaking thing for See How They Run. I don't know.
I do think, since you bring up supporting actor, I still think Eddie Redmayne has a chance to get in here. I feel like he is promoting the heck out of this movie, The Good Nurse, and it is a really strong performance. Obviously, the movie doesn't really have any momentum anywhere else in the race, but I do feel like he just has had such success with getting nominated, and he's obviously won before, that I feel like there's still a chance he gets into that weird group.
The category is so front-loaded with dual contenders, the Fabelmans guys and the Banshees guys. And because it looks like the Banshees guys are pretty strong, I think at this point, Brendan Gleeson and Barry Keoghan are very likely to be nominated. There's a lot of room for surprise. And someone like Eddie Redmayne or like Ben Whishaw as the real sole representative of their movie, a lot of screen time, a lot of emoting, they have a path for sure.
I wonder what year there were more Irish actors than English actors nominated. That's
a great question.
This might be the biggest ratio just for Banshees alone, honestly. I'm going back through Wikipedia just briefly, kind of trying to feel like what the least British year was. Like if you take out The Favorite from The Favorite year, which is a pretty big ask, that's a pretty American year. And then 2016 is interesting because you have a lot of British people like Andrew Garfield and Ruth Nega is Irish, or who is the third? Oh, Naomi Harris, all playing Americans, which is an interesting wrinkle in that. But I think that Rory's stats about actual English nominees are correct.
That's interesting.
And I believe Olivia Colman and only Gwyneth Paltrow are the Brits who won for playing Brits, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Good for Gwyneth.
She was chuffed. And that's a Madonna joke, but not a Gwyneth Paltrow joke.
I mean, if we're doing Gwyneth Paltrow accent jokes, like it really is the 90s again, and I'm thrilled about it, honestly. Well, maybe Adam's question about will lead us to Colin Farrell and continue this topic, if you want to go to that one, Richard.
Yes. Adam writes, why do you think Brendan Fraser's narrative has been so strong this year as opposed to, say, Colin Farrell's? Both actors have never been nominated, and Colin Farrell has been consistently putting out quality performances and interesting films over the past few years. Why is Brendan Fraser still considered the lock, even though Banshees has been so popular? I don't know if he is anymore. I don't know.
This is the question, right?
Yeah. He means a lock to win. I don't think so anymore. I mean,
well, that had been the assumption for so long, though, among us included, I think.
I think we all sort of made a mistake assuming that before anyone had seen the movie, or like we seen an image, or we just, everyone, not just us, sort of jumped on that from the moment the log line came out, I think. And, you know, I think we've been watching how this film has been doing and how quiet it's been. And I mean, to me, he does not feel like a lock anymore.
To the question of buzz, I mean, it is clear that there's been a lot more focus on Brendan Fraser than Colin Farrell. And I mean, that's just been a learning experience for me because I, you know, I kind of grew up in the generation of his movies, and I have a lot of peers who love his stuff. And I was, you know, kind of a casual fan of his, but the depth of love for him and affection for him is really, really intense. And I was not fully aware of that. And if you see, like, the, you know, standing ovation he got at Venice where The Whale premiered, and just how many views that got and how substantial that standing ovation was, or just basically anything he does, it gets a ton of attention. Everything he says seems to get picked up in, you know, online aggregates and things like that. It just feels like there's so much attention on him that kind of overshadowed who will actually win the Oscar, at least for me. And that's kind of why I was like, oh, he's going to win. Everyone's talking about him. And that's not always how this works. It's seeming like that may not be how this works this year. But I think in the case of Colin Farrell, he's in more of an ensemble piece. I don't know that he has had as turbulent of a Hollywood journey. And he was never as big of a star as Brendan Fraser. So I think you take all those things, and that explains to some extent why Brendan Fraser has come into this race with so much more attention than Colin Farrell, even though Colin Farrell may prove to have more staying power.
I'm wondering about Colin Farrell being as big a star as Brendan Fraser. I feel like they're very close, right? I mean, he didn't have a Mummy franchise, but like for that like early 2000s, like he was the guy everywhere.
He was a big star, but yeah, I think it's the franchise question.
Yeah, fair enough.
And stuff that wasn't as enduring, you know?
Right.
I think that the key differences between the two, one is that Brendan Fraser's American, and two, this is much more of a comeback narrative. And kind of the question that Adam asked answers itself in a way by saying, Colin Farrell has been consistently putting out quality performances and interesting films over the past few years. Guess who hasn't? Brendan Fraser. And so it's a lot more exciting narratively that someone kind of comes out of the relative obscurity of TV work that no one's watching or whatever, and then has all this Oscar attention. But I mean, I could see a world in which Colin Farrell becomes the sole winner for Banshees somehow. I could also see Martin McDonagh weirdly like winning Best Director or something crazy like that, because I think the other difference of how we were predicting this back, like after I saw the movie in Venice, let's say the Whale, I mean, and Banshees was at Venice, is that like I didn't quite think that Banshees would, I knew it would hold on, but I feel like it's only grown in its profile kind of exponentially compared to The Whale, which has had, I think, trouble maintaining that buzz, especially now that people have seen it and don't really seem to be liking it.
Even though it's making money.
Yeah, because I think people are curious about it. And so in that sense, you're like, okay, the marketing that we had kind of criticized on this podcast was effective because people were curious about it. But I don't know, Banshees just seems like more of a down the middle sort of success story in some ways, even if it's not financially.
I mean, Banshees has made $8.7 million. It's made more than Fablemans at this point, which I'm surprised to learn as I pull up Box Office Mojo right now. I don't know if it will, like, Fablemans will open wider or has or whatever, but, you know, The Whale is still, like, really at the very, very beginning of it. The comparison I saw that I thought was interesting was to Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler. He's obviously a very different kind of celebrity than Brendan Fraser. I think even on his awards campaign, he was not kind of pulling off the, like, lovable position that Brendan Fraser has. But that's another Darren Aronofsky movie with a really commanding lead performance and one that really got the attention of the internet and kind of the people who talk about this stuff all day. Twitter didn't exist yet or barely existed back then. And then Sean Penn won the Oscar in the end for the second time within 5 years or something like that. And I don't think that Colin Farrell in Banshees is the same like transformative big, big performance like Sean Penn in Milk, but I think that's an interesting parallel.
Yeah, it is for sure. I think that the one difference being obviously that Fraser seems to have a lot of friends and fans within the industry, and I don't know that Mickey Rourke did. It's kind of like why people think that Sylvester Stallone lost, you know, to Mark Rylance ultimately was because a lot of people don't like Sylvester Stallone. Ditto Michael Keaton.
Yeah, Brendan Fraser didn't burn bridges the way that some of those guys did.
Yeah, but they are interesting. I mean, I don't know. I think Fraser's campaign has been, like, I watched the Actors on Actors with him and Adam Sandler that Variety put out. And didn't watch all of it, but like Fraser's was kind of had a weird energy to him. And I don't know, like, I wonder what he's like in a room, you know, whereas Colin Farrell could, I don't know, ask me directions and I'd be like, yes, I will marry you. Like,
Jamie Lee Curtis did say exactly that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And that video has been seemingly very popular. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I think maybe kind of like Redmayne versus Keaton, maybe Farrell wins in the sort of charm off that is the next few months of campaigning.
Yeah, that's a really good point. This is the time of year when, like, the hands that you shake can really tip the scales.
The one thing holding me back with Colin Farrell winning this category right now is it's not the kind of performance that usually wins this category. It's, you know, I would love to see it win, but you have someone like Austin Butler lurking.
He would be, I think if you made me predict right now who would win Best Actor, which is foolish because the nominations aren't out, I would put my money on Austin Butler. I mean, look no further than Rami Malek not that long ago. And I think Elvis is a much more popular movie than Bohemian Rhapsody, with a really similar narrative for a Best Actor win.
I think all three of these guys come with specific challenges to winning. Like, I think Austin Butler, unlike Rami Malek, you know, Rami Malek had just won an Emmy and he was a little bit more established as a prestige actor. Austin Butler, it's a bigger leap. But I kind of lean the same direction right now, Katie. It's just, yeah, each of them are in it. It's an interesting race right now.
I don't know how closely people are paying attention to this, but like, Austin Butler's PR team got him exactly the right SNL hosting slot. You know, last one before the holiday, big Cecily Strong final episode.
Eddie Murphy also did that a couple years ago, and I was like, great, he's winning the Oscar.
Oh, fair enough.
Doesn't always work, but yes, but I agree that is the strategy.
But it brought Austin Butler back into public view, you know, instead of just people watching Elvis on HBO Max or whatever. It kind of confirmed him as like a charismatic talent. You know, I haven't watched many of the sketches, but he seemed to do fine, which is about all you can ask of a host these days. So he's an interesting case because it, like you said, David, it's very rare that someone like Austin Butler wins having had no real Oscar-y resume prior to that or Emmy-ish.
Did you guys watch his monologue? It was wonderful.
Yeah,
he talked about his mom. His mom died at the same age that Elvis's mom died. Like, he was 23 when his mom died, and Elvis was 23 when his mom died, which, as if you've seen Elvis, you know, was a major moment for him. But I just thought it was lovely and really winning, and exactly the way that you might want if you were wanting to get nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, he's really, I mean, he's showing up on all those awards roundtables. I feel like he's kept this film alive, and I wouldn't be, all three of these guys, I feel like if any of them won tomorrow, I would be able, like, that makes perfect sense. Like, each of them has a narrative that makes sense to me to win this.
Great. I'm glad we've made a definitive decision. Decision here.
It's not between the two you asked about. It's between three.
You want to take the next one, Richard?
So, Katie, you mentioned box office, which somewhat actually pertains to the next two questions. But first of all, Heather writes from the UK. Sorry, UK, you're not going to have any nominees this year. no, you are. With the UK going through an economic crisis right now and many of this year's big awards contenders already available on VOD, I'm having to make some choices about what I go out to see this year and what I watch at home. So my question is, which of this year's Oscar hopefuls do you think really benefit from being seen on the big screen?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Empire of Light. I have advised people to go, and I've had, I think, about a... maybe 6-4 turnout in terms of like six people being like, oh my God, that was so good. Why does everyone hate it? And then four people being like, you've steered me wrong, Lawson.
I hate it and I hate you. I mean, I think that, you know, there's obvious answers like Avatar, which I think all of us would agree you should see on the big screen. But I was thinking about like Tar, which I saw in the, I haven't revisited it at home, but like that movie is so absorbing and really needs you to like go with it. And I think watching it at home would take away a lot of that. I mean, your attention span mileage may vary, but that would be a big one for me.
RRR.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've been watching that one at home and like regret it, honestly.
Yeah, it's fun. If you get the right crowd, it is a lot of fun, as I'm sure a lot of people listening know. But yeah, I like this question because it is a good occasion to go beyond the obvious examples. And Avatar is a near requirement.
Yeah.
As long as you can, at least. But there are, I think, a lot of interesting theatrical preferred movies here.
Also, I'm assuming because this Heather is from the UK that English is her first language. And in case it is, go see the international stuff in the theaters, because it's all the harder to like focus on subtitles when you have your phone and the dogs barking and everything like that, you know, and also those movies need the money, certainly. Mm-hmm. So if any of those contenders are playing, you know, films that were at Cannes or Venice or whatever, like maybe seek those out, because like I watched The Fabelmans at home. I think you can do that. You know, you can probably watch Banshees at home. The Whale, certainly. But yeah, I mean, you know, the big spectacles, obviously, and then maybe some stuff that needs the financial love.
I don't know if this is still in theaters, especially in the UK, but I think Triangle of Sadness is really a fun one to watch.
That's what I was going to say.
Because you feel the discomfort in the audience, and that is something that is really fun to experience.
Yeah, yeah. I watched that at New York Film Festival and had a really, the audience was right there with it. It was, I mean, there's a lot of good audience experience movies out there this year. Like Top Gun is a huge one, obviously. It may very well still be in theaters. I don't know.
Forever.
But yeah, like the range between Top Gun and Triangle of Sadness, but they're both movies you want to see with a crowd. That's a sign of a good year, I think.
One movie that I think benefits from a quieter theatrical experience is Women Talking. I saw it basically alone in a screening room before it premiered at Telluride. And, you know, I think that's why I found it as moving as I did. It was just kind of a very sacred experience. And I think it is not a movie that benefits from easy home distractions because it's so script driven, because it is so thoughtfully done and so carefully done, especially in the structure and the way it develops. So yeah, that would be one that I would say try to see in a theater if you can. It's out, I believe, as of this episode going live, right? Or on Friday.
Yeah.
Select cities.
Also, the moments when that movie goes big, you know, it's so confined within that barn for so much of it. And then when it gets expansive and Hildur Guðnadóttir's score ramps up, like you really want to feel that transition, I think. And I think you feel that more on a big screen.
And view it like a play that you'd want to see live, you know, like it's talking.
That's a good way. That's a good way of thinking.
Yeah.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
On to the next.
Yeah, on to the next.
All right. Well, speaking of box office, Lauren writes, it was a longer email. I apologize, Lauren. I've pared it down to the essential question, I think. With all these box office quote bombs, she says the new Disney movie being the latest, Strange World, I think she's talking about, right? Do we just need to redefine what success at the box office looks like? This is maybe more of a question for the town Matt Bologna, but I think something's got to give, right? I actually have a piece coming out, I think at some point in the magazine, about a little thing about like the failure of art house box office this fall for some titles at least, and like what that means and why we should still keep making the, or why studios should keep, you know, making and releasing those movies. But I tried to be optimistic, and I don't know how optimistic I am, because you can redefine success to a certain point, but like numbers are numbers.
Yeah. And like the numbers expectation for a Disney movie like Strange World is like going to be different from something like Tar, obviously. And I think Disney has set it, the standard for itself, where it's like, if it doesn't make $1 billion worldwide, it is nothing. And I don't know how healthy that is for them or for movies in general. And like we're watching it with Avatar right now, because it opened like slow-ish, which the first Avatar did as well. It didn't open the same as Spider-Man, whatever the last one was. And it shouldn't have. And I think even that, like, recalibrating on that scale might be happening and might be better for everybody.
I think it's also incumbent on the studios a little bit to tell us what to look for. Mm-hmm. Like Banshees is going to make probably about a fifth of what Billboards did, Three Billboards did in U.S. theaters, North American theaters. And so then for me, the question is like, how many people are watching this movie at home? Like, what is the,
yeah,
what is the breakdown versus, you know, pre-pandemic? Cause that's really what we're talking about. And how much audience is actually being lost versus how much has shifted? Because I know people who are just watching all these movies when they come out on VOD. I know some people who are not watching them at all. But there's definitely a sizable audience that's just not going to the theaters to see them. And that, to me, is something we just don't really have any grasp on that, or at least I don't. Like,
and they don't tell us. Like, we just don't know how much they've made off Banshees on VOD, and they never will tell us. And it's probably turning a profit, but we have no way of knowing.
Exactly. So that, to me, is the big question. Because, yeah, I think we do have to redefine for these movies what a success is, because otherwise it's looking very bleak and none of these movies will be made anymore, which I don't think will happen, but there does have to be a recalibration.
And this could be a year where actually Oscar nominations really do drive that kind of viewership. Like, oh, okay, so that was nominated for Best Picture. Oh, and it's on demand, so let me watch it, you know. In the old days, you'd see a literal box office bump sometimes from the Oscar. They would re-release the Best Picture winner or whatever.
Miss Daisy would be number one at the box office the weekend of the Oscars or something.
I don't know if that's going to happen, but, you know, if the VOD is more viable, because, you know, again, like you said, David, we don't really know, but I'm hoping it is. Because when you actually look at all of it arrayed, you're like, wow, this economy has cratered. Like, this kind of specialty box office fall movie thing is not a good year for that.
It does. It almost makes me hope that a specialty film that did not make a lot of the box office wins a ton of Oscars, because at least that studio can be like, these are worth making because look at all these Oscars we won. And that for a long time was part of the drive behind these studios still supporting these movies. And
well, that was Coda, right? I mean, it was never going to be like, that was a lot of factors for that. But I think that's the perfect example.
Yeah, but I think that may not be the case. I mean, the winner this year could very well be a huge box office movie. So,
well, do you count Everything Everywhere All at Once? I mean, it was a huge success for its budget, but like, you know, it made less than Morbius. I think its box office success for its scale has been part of that story.
For how much it was made for, it's definitely a box office success. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I think it's just the language around what is success. It has to change. And a lot of that, as David is saying, is up to the studios to make that change.
All right, here we have one. I think it's going to be pretty easy to answer. Amy writes, who do I need to bribe in Hollywood to get Angela Bassett a Best Supporting Actress nomination? Or Best Supporting Actress Oscar, I guess is really what she's asking. Nomination-wise, I don't think anybody. Like,
you can bribe us.
Happy to. Yeah.
We accept Omega Watches, any, you know, trips, places, whatever. but she's probably going to get nominated, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty impressed by that. Like, I feel like, because she'd be the first Marvel actor ever to be nominated. And it's like, after Wakanda Forever kind of opened and everyone's like, yeah, it's not as good as the original. Like, here we go. And now that it's just kind of like settled in place after all of that, kind of without anyone noticing, I thought.
Yeah. You want to talk about the narrative around an actor who has not been nominated in a long time, who it just kind of coalesced, I think, quite easily for her in a way of, yeah, why not? Like, this is a messy category. She's the obvious play from this movie. She's great in this movie. And it's Angela Bassett. And she hasn't been nominated since, you know, over 20 years. So, yeah, I think that refreshingly was not as tough a sell as people feared.
It will always kind of bum me out that Michael B. Jordan just couldn't get there for the first one. Not that, like, their performances are really different. And I think played different roles in the movies. But he really deserved it.
I do think I think it's possible for her to win too. I mean, we have a long way to go to get there, but this supporting actress race is so weird, and she's such a giant name and would be being honored sort of for her career, you know, in general, not just this film, that I see a path for her to win as well, especially if she just like charms the heck out of everyone in the next, you know, couple months on the trail.
Well, we keep talking about Jamie Lee Curtis, the thing that I get hung up on in that is, like, we all think Ke Huy Quan is kind of locked in. Like, Michelle Yeoh, I mean, we can talk about Best Actress if we want. I think she's still very much in it to win there. Like, does Everything Everywhere get 3 Oscars, or does Supporting Actress kind of start shaking out?
I think it's like the Wild West. I have no idea. The one good thing about Jamie Lee Curtis for her campaign is she's kind of Hollywood royalty. And mm-hmm.
Literally, she's a nepo baby.
She is. Yes, we mentioned Gwyneth Paltrow. We're inching toward the nepo baby discourse of the week. It's a totally different narrative from Ki Kwan or Michelle Yeoh. While she will also be a first-time nominee, it's under very different circumstances. It's a very different performance from those two. And I think she's going to win the Golden Globe. So she has a head start.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a couple questions about a similar topic, so I'll read them together. First off, Indigo writes, "All right, guys, I have a real belief that Rihanna, after not releasing anything for 6 years, will take Best Song. It would mean the Academy have their easy acknowledgement of Wakanda Forever, and of course I don't think anyone would complain about Rihanna being an Oscar winner. Just a thought, but I also believe it more than anything else in the season so far, so we'll get to that." And then we also have Alicia wrote in and said, "A couple weeks ago, when the topic of Best Original Song came up, Disenchanted, Disney's Enchanted sequel, didn't come up in the discussion. Is it eligible?" So let's do the first one, Rihanna winning an Oscar for the Wakanda Forever song, which is quite a powerful moment in the film.
We should start by saying that this podcast will be out after the shortlists are out, but we're recording before. So if there is a shocking snub, we are not aware of it.
Yep. I also feel like we need to answer the second one first, which is that Disenchanted is not eligible, which I think is silly and a missed opportunity, but it's true.
Because it was streaming.
Yes, it was only streaming. And unlike Turning Red, which is eligible for having been released in whatever way, even though it was mostly seen on Disney Plus, it's not.
You got to think about Disney releasing Strange World in theaters and it tanking and then putting Disenchanted on Disney Plus. And it's like, what if you'd flipped that?
It's wild.
Like, why wasn't Disenchanted in theaters? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, there's a new CEO in town who might have some thoughts about that. Might be listening right now.
Yep.
Okay, but we should talk about Rihanna. Honestly, I just think she has to get past Lady Gaga first, and that's not that easy.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there are a couple other big heavy hitters kind of lurking in the shadows, too. You know, you have Taylor Swift, and I think Diane Warren has a song.
Billie Eilish and Phineas wrote the song from Turning Red, which is great.
Right.
And, you know, when the shortlist comes out, that's going to be the first one I'm going to be looking for, because I feel like it's flown under the radar undeservingly.
But I think that Indigo is correct in pointing out that, like, you know, we just talked about Bassett, but, like, for a win, song would be a good place to do it. You have one of the world's biggest celebrities accepting that award.
Mm-hmm.
It's for a very powerful moment in the film, the sort of defining emotional closing note of the film. And it really plays in the movie, not just over credits. And I don't know. I think that would be strong and it would be really fun to have her there. I mean, gay Twitter would melt down, which is always the goal of the Oscars, I think, at this point. I would welcome that. I mean, Gaga's great, and I love that song, but, like, she's already won. So let's bring in a new pop diva.
I sort of feel like it's going to be between those two.
Mm-hmm.
You have movies like RRR, and I love the White Noise song, and, you know, and the Turning Red song is great, too, but Billie Eilish has also already won. It just feels like this is going to be a big star matchup for big movies, as it should be.
I feel like I have to say, to stay true to myself, that Lyla Crocodile's still in the hunt, but they did submit one of the worst songs, I think, on the soundtrack, not the, like, great, like, song and dance number. So I'm not keeping my hopes up too high. If it's on the shortlist, I'll be thrilled. But I'm going to put my weight behind someone else, I think, unfortunately.
Katie, please tell me it's a song that Harvey Arbredem sings. That means he'll perform at the Oscars.
It's
please,
not.
Please.
This is the thing. It's a Shawn Mendes song. And Shawn Mendes has a great voice. He's the crocodile. But it's just, it's like the slow. It's like Dos Oruguitas. Like, they submitted the slow ballad instead of the big fun song that everyone liked. Although I don't think any of the songs from Lyle are quite as popular. So we don't talk about Bruno, but there's still time. David, you mentioned RRR, and people should watch the Natu Natu clip, even if they haven't seen the whole movie, which I imagine would play better on the big screen. But I think if you watch that clip once, you just would beg the Oscar gods to nominate that song so that we can see that performance, because, man, it would be fun.
And it feels like the kind of spoiler to a big star winning this, because it
is...
You think
it could win?
I mean, would I predict it right now? No, over Lady Gaga, Rihanna, but... The movie has been gaining steam, and if enough people watch it, you know, you want to talk about a song that is so much a part of what makes the movie special, like, this is literally that. And so I could see it pulling it off and it being a really surprising, rousing moment at the Oscars. I'm not,
like,
you know,
it's hard out here for a pimp for 2023.
Yes.
That was a fun moment.
I mean, how much with this category do you think, like, campaigning even matters? Or is it just about, I can't ever tell if it's like the song has to be an earworm, or like Beyonce was nominated last year and I was like, well, they're going to give it to Beyonce, but obviously they didn't. And so I feel like this category, it can surprise us so often. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't work the same as other categories.
When her won for Judas and the Black Messiah.
Yeah.
And I didn't even really remember the song, and it was a good song, but it was just, it felt really random to me because that movie didn't have the most heat in that category, and she wasn't the biggest name in that category, and it all was just sort of a strange coalescing.
Well, there was a rule that year that if you perform on the roof of the new Academy Museum, you have to win.
So. I think they all did, though. I think Diane Warren performed up there.
Did she really? Oh, you're right. Yeah. She did. Yeah. I thought it was just her for some reason.
When I went to the Academy Museum, I was like, ah, I'm on Diane Warren's roof.
I love that that's how you remember that.
Of course.
I think one thing to keep in mind also is that the Academy, when it comes to best song, can be a little snooty about pop stuff.
You know,
and pop stars, and it's not serious music. And like, obviously, there is a long history of big pop stars winning the Oscar. But I think it's a little different when Gaga wins for something kind of musical, alt rock sort of thing for Star Is Born, than an out and out pop tune in the style of a Diane Warren, who has never won, you know, competitively.
That's exactly the point.
So, yeah. Okay, let's go to an Oscar history one, because these are fun. So it's Ross writes, an interesting question. Having a sequel nominated for Best Picture is not unheard of. Godfather 2, the Lord of the Rings sequels. However, if Glass Onion and
Top Gun Maverick,
get Best Picture nominations, would that be the first time a sequel was nominated for Best Picture without the first movie getting the nomination? It would be even crazier considering both would be in the same year. So, Katie, I think you have a quick answer to this already.
Yeah, I think this came up. I don't know if it was talking to you guys or something else. So Mad Max Fury Road, I think, is the big obvious correlation here. And then also Toy Story 3, weirdly, from that period where Pixar movies just got nominated for Best Picture every single year. But it didn't happen in the, era of five Best Picture nominations, which for a reason, I think, for all this kind of like bias that we're talking about. But two sequels in the same year, that'd be really something. And two very different kinds of sequels to two very different kinds of movies.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I feel like before everyone started writing about the Marvel kind of ruling the universe, it was just like, oh, sequels are just, that's all that's in theaters. And now just a decade or so later, we're like, yeah, we're ready for sequels to win where the predecessor were not nominated. And we've just kind of adapted, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you could also count Black Panther as a sequel if you wanted to, because it was after the events of Captain America Civil War. But, depends on how crazy you want to go.
And Avatar.
And that's true. Well, I guess the first one was nominated, so it wouldn't be.
Well, the first one was nominated, but
Do we think there's gonna be three sequels: Avatar, Top Gun Maverick, and Glass Onion in the Best Picture lineup?
A minimum of two. I think the strange thing about Glass Onion is, you look at a Top Gun Maverick or a Mad Max Fury Road, and these are movies that so clearly artistically surpassed what came before them, and they were just these like unbelievable phenomenons with audiences and critics, and Glass Onion, while certainly not a letdown compared to the first one, is not radically better or different. And so if it were to get in, unlike the first one, and granted the category has expanded a little bit, so, and Knives Out was on the cusp, so it could be in the exact same position as the other one was. But it is a strange case of a sequel outdoing the original despite not reinventing the wheel in a substantial way.
Tar is technically a sequel to Blue Jasmine, because the character got her stuff together, learned how to conduct, and
it created an entire fictional backstory for herself.
I mean, it is. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I think that like, it's weird that I don't feel like icky about that prospect. I think because those movies feel deserving-ish. And in the case of Top Gun, like, thanks for helping to save the industry for yet another year. And then Tom Cruise jumped out of a plane to say thanks.
Continues to jump out of planes. He just can't stop him.
All right. So last question is from Frank. He writes, what relatively recent Oscar win seems most unjustly forgotten? And which one is very justly forgotten?
I did research on this because I got nervous when I saw it and thought like I wasn't going to be able to come up with an answer on the spot. So what I came up with for Justly Forgotten is the fact that George Clooney's Oscar is for Best Supporting Actor in Syriana, a movie that doesn't really exist anymore. And even when he won it, he was nominated for Best Director in the same year. And he was like, well, I guess I'm not winning director because you gave me this Oscar. Like, it was already kind of a throwaway Oscar the moment he accepted it. Not that I have anything against George Clooney having an Oscar, but it's a strange one for him to have. But then I was kind of in that same period of time and just looking back at the original screenplay winners run of the early 2000s, and specifically Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is, you know, this was a period where like a great movie that was like too cool to get nominated for Best Picture would win original screenplay. You got Talk to Her, you got Lost in Translation, which was nominated but didn't win. Gosford Park wins this, Almost Famous wins this. Like that was like 5 years in a row. Just incredible winners in that one category. And then Crash wins in 2005 and breaks the spell a little bit. But I think we should talk about that more.
Katie, I'm not a geopolitics expert, but I think Syriana is actually pretty good.
Oh, yeah? I haven't seen it since 2000, whatever, four, whenever it came out.
I mean, you watch Syriana and you're like, this guy is definitely going to make a Dr. Doolittle movie. You know? such a weird career he's had. Yeah, it's and Clooney's great in it. It's an interesting movie. It's like, you know, it's Traffic, but about oil.
Sure, maybe I need to take it back.
But I know that's a fair choice. I mean, I just out of personal grudge, I would say, and I think it is kind of justly forgotten, is Birdman. I don't feel like that's a movie people talk about as like a new classic or anything. And yet,
the fact that it won Best Picture is kind of bananas.
Yeah, I mean, considering it was up against Boyhood and, you know, Selma and even Whiplash at that point, that was a weird year. Unjustly Forgotten, I don't know, that's tough. I feel like that's so relative, but you know, I feel like I've forgotten Shape of Water, even though I really liked it at the time, and maybe I should revisit it.
That's such a nice, like, for to have a movie like that, that's like a nice fairy tale romance, win Best Picture, is such a strange thing to happen. And as we keep talking about, like, what is quote-unquote Best Picture worthy keeps changing very rapidly. But it's an interesting outlier in kind of the grand history of that category.
My Justly Forgotten is quite specific in that I think The King's Speech is definitely remembered as a Best Picture winner, but it winning Best Original Screenplay over another year. Inception, which like is not my favorite movie, but it was such a screenplay movie and it's such a, you know, quoted movie. And The Kids Are All Right is kind of insane to me.
The Fighter, which is pretty good, too.
I scrolled right past The Fighter. And I like The Fighter, so that was not intentional. To me, it's just a great example of a Best Picture winner sort of dragging along the screenplay win for absolutely no reason, because especially the original screenplay category, like the category of Eternal Sunshine, like exactly what you were saying, Katie, it's so sad to me that that is the movie that you would highlight, even if it's a perfectly respectable movie. And even if the Academy, you know, eats up Colin Firth's performance and Tom Hooper's very respectable direction, it's so not a screenplay movie. It's not a screenplay that's exciting or that, you know, is worth, in my opinion, highlighting. So I think Justly Forgotten, or now I'm, you know, have renewed rage about it. So I guess it's not forgotten anymore, but it, for most people, I don't hear that very often. Rebecca, why don't you do one?
I had a hard time picking these because I feel like the minute I would look at something, I'd be like, oh, I haven't forgotten about that. Like the rage still sits down in my stomach. So it's, I'm going to bring up Jared Leto in the Dallas Buyers Club because you know, that when I forgot about it, when I was looking at the list, and then I was like, oh, no, I did not forget about that because that was such a weird year and set him on a path to be, you know, nominated for other things. And to me, that's just one that I don't even know which category I would put that in other than it doesn't sit well with me even.
Who should have won? So Jared Leto beats Bar Kadabi.
It was such a weird year that, I mean,
I would have given it to Michael Fassbender, maybe.
I think Fassbender would have...
For 12 Years a Slave.
Would have made me look over the list now and be like, okay, yeah. When instead I'm like, what happened here? So that's my pick for This Doesn't Sit Well With Me, which I know is not the exact name of this category, but that's how I'm answering
I love it. And then in terms of my unjustly forgotten, I don't know if it's like forgotten.
We don't forget. Of, that's what we don't
care. Yeah, yeah. So it's we're bad at this. But Mark Rylance is really extraordinary in Bridge of Spies. Also, I'm going by the recent rubric. So
yeah, yeah.
Mark Rylance is really extraordinary in Bridge of Spies. And that category seemed to be Sylvester Stallone's for a while. And it was such a, I think it's also such an exciting upset. And I remember, I forget who presented it, but they said Marker. And I was like, oh, Mark Ruffalo won for Spotlight. And then I was like, no, it was Mark Rylance. And it was very exciting. So it was more like that moment. And he's such a phenomenal actor. And it was kind of, it was nice to see them go with the performance over the name. Much as I liked Sylvester Stallone in Creed, it was a rare triumph for something a little quieter, maybe.
Going through all this, I was thinking, like, I would love it if Alicia Vikander won an Oscar someday. You know, yes, she's deserving, but she's not won. She hasn't won for anything.
Not even nominated.
Nope, nope, it hasn't happened. Yeah, that's, I think, a very justly forgotten.
With, that's sort of the infamous one, yeah.
Yeah, like it's
we
so
don't
infamous
forget that other people have forgotten that she won that. And I think she probably would like to forget it. That movie is a big old problem. Speaking of Tom Hooper, actually.
Anne Hathaway. No.
Tom Hooper has had a crazy Oscar run. Like, those three movies, like Les Mis, that, and Danish Girl, like, that's pretty...
And Judi Dench for Cats.
Right, of course, yeah, famously.
You guys are making me feel insane. Because Cats came out right before the pandemic, and my memory of that whole period is so fuzzy. I'm like, Judi Dench got nominated for Cats? Is that possible? And it made me feel like I'm losing my mind.
What's interesting about the Tom Hooper, Alicia Vikander combo wins is that neither of them have the careers right now of Oscar winners in any way, shape, or form for various reasons.
That's no, you know, no knock on her. She was great on Irma Vep. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked her in, what was that movie? The Justin Chan movie. Blue Bayou.
Oh, Blue Bayou. Really, yeah, she's great in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, she, I mean, and Michael Fassbender are married to each other. Like, he hasn't made a movie in, like, 4 years. Like, he's really been gone. And he's in the Taika Waititi soccer comedy coming out in the spring from Searchlight, which, you know, may or may not be a big deal. But yeah, maybe they just like want to live in wherever they live and have a baby and do nothing. I don't know.
I feel like this question would be really fun for nominations, because we all remember the wins, I think, whether they were terrible or wonderful. But I feel like there's so, when looking over these lists and just being, that person got nominated for this? No, mm-hmm. You know, those are the ones we erase from our memory pretty quick.
Trumbo.
Yeah. Yeah, this was, I was on a long drive and trying to kind of distract myself. And I was like, okay, name all of last year's Best Picture nominations. And I could not settle on whether Nightmare Alley had gotten nominated. I had to look it up when I got home because I just didn't remember. It did. Didn't it remember did. That.
I did a Q&A over the weekend with Jenny Slate for Marcel. It was a part of the MoMA Contender series. And MoMA has the Del Toro exhibit going on at the Film Center now. And I walked down the escalator to go meet the publicist. And there were just all of these Nightmare Alley posters, because it's part of the exhibit, I guess. And I was like, oh, right, that movie from last year. Yeah. Like, that I completely forgot existed.
It's like you time traveled back in late 2021 all of a sudden.
One of the best final scenes attached to a not great movie.
Yep.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as the regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after the regime airs.
Okay, let's go from our mailbag to my conversation with Michael Barker and Tom Bernard, the co-presidents of Sony Pictures Classics. As I said, we kind of look back over their 30-year history at the studio and then get really in the nitty-gritty of their Oscar campaign strategy, which we've talked about a lot, where they kind of like break late in the season. We talk about The Father and Anthony Hopkins, and then about Living with Bill Nighy and maybe being able to repeat that same process. A note that there were some technical difficulties, and at one point, kind of halfway through, they wind up sitting in the same room together because they work together and we're next door. So you might notice that difference in there, but it's a great conversation and worth listening to. So let's hear it. So So I'm joined now by Tom Bernard and Michael Barker, the co-founders and co-presidents of Sony Pictures Classics, the distributors of many, many great films that turns 30 this year, right? Not 2023. 2022 is the big 30th anniversary.
Yes.
Happy anniversary to you both. Thanks for coming to talk to me.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the big Blu-ray set and the anniversary and everything, but because we are an awards-obsessed podcast, I wanted you guys to flash back with me to an Oscars a couple years ago and the moment that Joaquin Phoenix read Anthony Hopkins' name from the Best Actor envelope, which was kind of a thrilling surprise for all of us who watched the Oscars, kind of hoping for something new to happen that we don't expect. Where were you guys when that moment happened, and what do you remember feeling in that moment?
Well, I was pretty excited. I was at home watching on TV, and I had placed a large bet on Anthony Hopkins because I felt very confident that he was going to win. And I was, you know, I would have been surprised if he hadn't, you know, to be honest with you. It was something that, you know, we had worked very hard at, and we've been in the business for a real long time. And so we felt just from our vibe and the people we felt we knew out there and the quality of the work that Anthony Hopkins had put in, that would speak to the voters. And it was wonderful, you know, and Anthony Hopkins was home asleep. And we told him to be ready to get up in the morning and do his acceptance speech on Instagram, which he did, which was an incredible speech that I think probably got more eyeballs than he would have if he'd been on the show because it was so late.
That's true. Michael, were you also at home?
I was sitting at home with my two cats watching it and thinking how weird it was to be exhilarated and being there with two cats, you know? So the thing that was interesting to me is so many of the pundits and journalists and critics I had talked to over the months did not believe he was going to win. And after he won, about 12:15 at night until 1 a.m., all those pundits were calling, not all, but many of them were calling me on my phone, but I didn't take one of their calls. And no, it was a very exciting time in the sense that that was a movie that prevailed through the pandemic. And it was not an easy film. It would have been easy for us to sell it to a streamer because we were in the pandemic. We just had real faith in that film, and it turned out well.
You know, we didn't go there. This is the first time since 1985 we weren't at the Oscars. Wow. I think Michael, 86. And so it was a very surreal experience watching it on TV because, you know, we hadn't watched it on TV since the early 80s. And so just looking at that totally different experience was very, I don't know. It was just unlike anything that I'd experienced in the world of the Oscars.
It was a weird Oscar ceremony in general, too. It wasn't just for you, for everyone.
Yeah, it didn't seem like the Oscars. You know what I mean? It was like we have so many moments that we can go through over the years. I mean, you know, our big moment was, I guess, when we first started Sony Classics and Hour's End, you know, won Best Actress, I think, in screenplay.
Another thing that was very gratifying about that event was that Chloe Zhao won director and picture. And 2 years before, we waged a campaign. She deserved to be nominated for best director. And it was just so difficult to crack. And so it was just so gratifying to see her win that. And we had been part of her trajectory in her career, as it is this year. You know, when Tom and I see people like Luca Guadagnino being in the conversation again, and we released Call Me By Your Name, or Damien Chazelle in the conversation again, and we had Whiplash, and then there's Guillermo del Toro, and Cate Blanchett. We were with the Oscars with her with Blue Jasmine. That is as gratifying as being in the room with your own nominee, you know?
Really as gratifying? You don't want to have a little bit of...
yes, it is. We are really happy for them because we were part of their history, you know?
It's a lot more fun being in the room, but it's also satisfying that they're certainly on their way. But there's nothing like that experience in there. It's just the tension in the air every year, or some incredibly odd event happens, you know, where they pull the wrong name out of the hat. You know,
hopefully that never happens again.
Yeah.
No, Tom is right. When there's just an amazing thing that happens that you just don't expect, obviously the slap last year. But I remember the year when Elia Kazan got
the Lifetime Achievement
Award, and Nick Nolte and Ed Harris sat on their, you know, hands. It was a moment to live in. It was a historical moment that was kind of unexpected.
Yeah. I mean, I think The Father is, you know, not only a triumph for you guys, but really emblematic of the strategy that we talk about in this podcast this time of year, where this year it's Living, being like, oh, wow, it didn't feel like anyone had seen Living. But then all of a sudden, Bill Nighy showing up everywhere. And it's this process where in January and February, people are discovering these movies. And in the case of Living, it premiered at Sundance over a year ago. I mean, how long has that been your strategy through this? And why is it so successful?
Well, I can say one thing. Michael can get into the nitty-gritty of it. But our goal with when we buy a movie is we buy a movie because we think we know how to make it work in the marketplace, that it has certain attributes that I think are you know, good for the world and fit in our Sony Classics library. And from the beginning, that movie, we felt that. And the fact is, our whole goal is simply to get the Academy to watch the film. That is it. Everything is done to get everyone. If everyone watches each film, you're going to get you're going to get the best choices there. And it's just, it's so hard. Now there's 10,000 people you're pushing to get to the film. We have the site. The Academy always throws a different set of rules that either get in the way or help of getting you to see the film. Now there's no more DVDs. That's a big factor. There's a lot of people that still have to have their grandchildren work their computers.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, that's simply our goal.
I think you need a lot of time with a movie like this. If you have faith in the movie, as we do with this film, this is a similar experience to the one we had with Capote, which is that was a film that had this star performance. We showed it and used the film fall film festivals. We showed it as many places as possible. We floated it out there. Hey, pay attention to this director. Pay attention to the screenplay. Pay attention to different aspects of the film. We did that with Call Me By Your Name, and we did that with Whiplash as well. And you get results if you have the film that has the qualities that can do it. And if you can, as Tom says, if you can get enough Academy members to focus and see the film.
Yeah. And so having it, you know, out there, you know, opening in theaters late, is that part of the strategy of getting them to see it? Does that get attention more than if you open it in October and then had the screeners
coming
out?
No, you know, every film is different. This film felt like a real Christmas picture. It has a great feeling at the end of it, like It's a Wonderful Life. It just makes sense to play it at Christmas. But yes, we could have opened in October. But the fact of the matter is, we had so many opportunities. Every film festival wanted. It's very rare that Telluride will play a film that plays in Sundance. Mm-hmm. It's very rare that Toronto will do it. And it was in all of those festivals. And that makes a big difference.
You guys have built this company on relationships with these filmmakers. And the award season push is part of that. But do you... what is that conversation like where you're like, okay, these are the events you're going to have to go to. This is how long this is going to take. This is why it's worth it. Are people resistant to that, or do they understand kind of the campaign involved here?
The filmmakers trust us, and it's been gratifying. They trust us in our plans and the campaign. And when we say this is a film that's slow and steady wins the race kind of thing with the public or maybe an award or two. The filmmakers, by and large, they believe that. They believe in the films. I can't think when we've had real pressure to open quickly. You know, the rationale and the reasoning makes sense to them. And also, they looked at what we have done before. I remember when Luca Guadagnino made it very clear to the other producers of Call Me By Your Name that he wanted us, because he had observed what we did with independent films in the awards pay space and in the consumer space, films that were not easy to label.
Were there any films any of particular of your films that he was inspired by there? I'm thinking of Almodovar, but I wonder.
Well, he was inspired by all the Almodovar films.
Yeah, okay, that's what I thought.
Of all the Almodovar films. But Luca is quite a film maven, and he was inspired, you know, by so many things he saw that we had done, like With an Education and Capote and Midnight in Paris and these kind of films, you know. They're not obvious big awards getters, you know, as far as nominations in other categories.
Continue on Luca, but I can give you one little Oscar thing that I think sums up a lot of strategies for today.
Please.
Is there was a cable channel called the Z Channel in Los Angeles back in the 80s. And one day, I think the Woody Allen movie, Annie Hall, showed on it in January. And that year it won the Oscar. And it was the first time a large majority of people saw the film, because they all had Z Channel. It was like the coolest thing to happen in L.A. And so that sort of told the tale to us about the goal is get the Academy to see the film and the work will speak for itself.
Do you ever get filmmakers or actors who get superstitious about all the awards talk? And sometimes people really don't like to talk about it in those terms, but it's obviously your job to do so.
You know, what's interesting about that, there are a lot of actors and directors that don't want to campaign for awards, but they realize by doing all the press and the interviews, not only does it reach the consumers to get them to see the movies, but if for some reason the nominations become real, that also helps a wider audience base. And mm-hmm. that's what convinces those people who are very cautious about it.
So let's talk about this year in particular, which the story that you keep seeing is that the theatrical marketplace has just been a disaster, and specifically for smaller specialty films. And you guys are pretty committed to theatrical distribution. So I'm imagining you're going to push back on that idea that audiences have disappeared for these smaller films.
Well, I think it's not that they're disappearing. It's that they're very slow in coming. The audience for independent films is very slow in coming back to the movie theaters. And that process is just taking a long time. It's taking a long time for exhibitors to adapt and change their ways, the marketing and so forth. It's just taking a long time. And I would suggest it's not just independent films. If you take away the horror genre, the family genre, and the those tentpole franchise movies, I think all the other movies have a difficult time at this particular moment. But theatrical, in our view, will never go away, because it is the distinctive, the way you can make your title distinct in the marketplace, as opposed to it being a part of an index on a platform. And that distinctive release, and social media is a godsend because it doesn't cost you what it cost you before. And that particular distinctive release can cause those movies to have such a long tail. And we feel over time, the audience is slowly going to come back. It's just a slow process. And even if at the end of the day, the box office is not as high as it used to be, we still have made those titles instinctive and memorable enough in the marketplace for people to view it in another way. Mm-hmm. And so the pictures have a long history. And to be honest with you, even before the pandemic, we've been here 30 years. And one of the keys to our being here 30 years is that we view these films as having a long tail. And if you look at these films we released early in our time at Sony Pictures Classics, like Run Lola Run, like Crumb, like Orlando, City of Lost Children, in some cases, they're even doing better on the platforms and on these television and so forth than they did years ago. And these films have more than cult status, and they have a long tail. So we're playing not only trying to get as many people as possible in the theaters at the beginning, but we're playing this strategy of imprinting on the public's mind the title and what it is, so they can visit it, and if they love it, they revisit it again and again. I have to tell you, during the pandemic, Tom and I received a call from the heads of Sony Home Entertainment, and at that moment in the pandemic, Call Me By Your Name was the movie that was garnering the most eyeballs and the most revenue of any film in the Sony Pictures library. That is incredible. That's incredible.
I can imagine an Italian vacation in the pandemic. I can see why that'd be something that you would put on.
There's always a moment in the year where they say the business is over. And really, the issues going on right now, it's disruption, I think, is a key word. I met this guy who was a professor at university, at UCLA, who's majors, he teaches disruption. And right now, what is going on is there's disruption in the industry because the world, and especially after COVID, the world has finally come into the internet in a way that all ages can work it. You know, my 93-year-old mother can text me. I think a lot of people who, you know, wanted to interact with their families who were old learned how to work the computer. And they also learned that whatever they wanted showed up on their computer. They didn't go look for it. They didn't have to do anything. The computer information found you. And so the issue is right now that the theaters are sort of like my mother, and, really need to be educated on how to organize their data and reach their customers, because these independent theaters don't do that. And so you don't know what's playing, one, because the newspaper's gone. You don't see the review every Friday. The movie clock isn't there. And if you're an older person, you know, Rotten Tomatoes may not be your favorite dish, or you don't really know. It just randomly comes to you sometimes if you're watching TV, or you might see a TV spot, or your neighbor says something, or you just say, you know what, I don't know what's playing in the theaters. Streaming is just enough. And so our goal has been to try and get the theaters back into the future. And Angelica Theaters, we work with very carefully, and we're now partnering with them with our social media and with trying to collect the data on their customers and have a customer base where, you know, in the old days, you got a calendar in the mail. That was like the really old days. And you put it on the refrigerator and they knew you went to the movies at that theater. And so now we need to customize it. So if you like Pedro Almodovar, or we've got a movie that maybe is politically relevant in some way, or it's got an actor that's very famous, we need to know who likes those people. And we'll be able to reach them. And on Tuesday, they get an email and they say, geez, we got to get a seat and reserve it. So Tuesday or Wednesday, they buy a ticket. And so that's one of the main things, is to get the theaters to move into the business of every other business, which reaches you on the internet for everything from a concert to a car to a restaurant to clothing. And then the second thing is to need to motivate people to go back to the movies. So what did we do back in, I guess it was April, we opened a movie and said, okay, theater, this is what we're going to do with you. We're going to do 2-for-1 on this movie, but it's not going to say 2-for-1. It's going to say, bring a friend back to the movies for free. We did that with Angelica.
With the Duke, and that was successful.
And we were we're the highest gross in the complex. We did it in all their theaters around the country. They actually outgrossed Landmark Theater Chain with half the theaters. With getting older people to put into their conversation, hey, we should go back to the movies. Let me call my friend. And so it's creating a motivation to go back. It's having Senior Tuesday. It's you know, what you've seen now is a lot of the Q&As are happening on the weekends. And you see this odd phenomenon where the biggest gross is Friday instead of Saturday, because they've also had some event on Thursday and folded the numbers into the Friday number. So but they're not all on the same page. And the chains, they're going after a different group of people. They're going after the younger audience which is internet savvy. And so if you have a Spider-Man or Doctor Strange Black Panther, the fact is these guys on the studio level now are using the internet. You don't see the same amount of TV spots for a lot of movies that are doing incredible amounts of business, but you certainly get a lot of information in all the other places that you look. And so it's a real disruption in changing how the business works. It's the theaters, the studios are not that, well, the studios are still pumping out the dollars, but in the specialized business, it's not that business. And the theaters need to work closely and combine their efforts. If I'm going to send the studio or the theater $5,000 to do co-op advertising with me, I want to talk to them about how they're going to spend it now.
In a way that you wouldn't have 10 years ago, maybe.
That's right. We were just giving it to them and, they would have put it in all their, calendar and all the usual things. But they're at a loss right now what to do.
Well, what it sounds like, you're kind of talking about like what the Netflix algorithm does, being like, well, you liked this thing, maybe you would like this one, but on a much more specialty kind of human level. But do you feel like you're kind of learning from that algorithmic recommendation and trying to apply it?
Well, forget their algorithm. If you rent these three movies, here's three more movies we're going to send you in the mail on a DVD. I mean, that mm-hmm. was way back. And those guys, and what that did is that replaced the critics, because back then the critics really were about the movies. It wasn't about their interpretation. It was how they saw the movie and what it was about. And was a way you could gauge how you might like the film. Whereas this time you find critics that maybe have likes that you like that are very we're personal in terms of how they interpret the film, rather than something where a guy like Vincent Canby, who was a New York Times critic years ago, could hate a movie and you would read that review and go, boy, I'm going to like that. You don't see that anymore. And so,
yeah. So I want to talk about the box set and the anniversary that you guys have. And honestly, kind of on a broader topic of like what a Sony Pictures Classics movie is, because the range in this box set is really immense. And I don't know what the process was for choosing, because you're choosing, 30 years worth of movies for one box. But was the hope with this box set to say, here is the absolute range of what we can do and what our history says?
I don't know if those 11 titles show the complete range. As you said, what we couldn't get over is we had almost 500 titles when this was brought up and Home Entertainment wanted to do this. And we wanted to mention titles that have been so successful over the years, even if some of them weren't so successful when they first came out.
Mm-hmm.
City of Lost Children is so much more successful now than when it came out. Then you have movies that were successful then, like Orlando and Run Lola Run, but their lives are richer than you can imagine as far as popularity. And then we wanted to show the range of that, from SLC Punk to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And it was really Home Entertainment chose those titles.
And, oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was, because they looked at the fan base of each of those films, and there's a wide range of people, a wide range of demographics, and to see those movies transferred to this HD is so impressive, technically.
You look at a movie like SLC Punk, which is an oddball film. That movie had a resurgence like 6 years after it, disappeared, and it did, mildly okay. But it's now became a new cult film of a new generation that was sort of they wanted to emulate the punk lifestyle of the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel that the movies all have something to say, and very seldom do they just disappear. There might be one or two that that just didn't work. We saw it wrong. But, I can't say that there's a movie in the library that we're not proud of or happy to have.
Of course, there's some that have been disappointments in the marketplace, but we're proud of all of them, we really feel for those gentlemen who made The Climb, because that was a victim of the pandemic,
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to originally open the week after all the offices shut down.
We had this movie called Denise Calls Up. It was about first time cell phones became like in the culture,
to look back on it, it's pretty entertaining and funny, but it didn't quite connect.
You know, The Climb is interesting, though, because Cal Marv is now directing that big 80 for Brady movie. So his profile keeps rising despite the pandemic. So
yeah, absolutely. And then we opened it a year later. So it definitely always had its fans. And that will grow, too.
I was just on the phone with one of the producers of The Climb yesterday. And we were talking about once the ghosts of the pandemic disappeared, and maybe try and open it again.
Yeah.
Because it was that good a film. And I mean, it opened like the week of March 13th when everything closed.
Yeah. Yeah. That was such a black hole, really. Maybe a question to end on, because you guys have talked about these relationships that you build and maintain over decades. And, you know, other than releasing their movies, like, what does that look like in the years between movies are out? What does it mean to you guys to keep those relationships intact, to keep building them, and to give your filmmakers support even when they're not making a movie, so that they keep coming back to work with you?
I think it's a relationship that has grown organically through the process of releasing their film. And they could come back to us a year later. They could call us 10 years later. And we like to think it was always a great experience for them to go through this process.
When we release a film, Michael and I are very involved from beginning to end. So Michael is on his way to Palm Springs to be with the people from Living. You know, we're at the 92nd Street Y when, you know,
Turn the Every Page.
I was up there with Living. Michael was up there with Turn Every Page. So we're there with them through this. If we say, hey, we want you guys to do this stuff and it's going to really, you know, be a bit taxing, well, we're going to be there with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in the festivals with them. We're there, you know, working them through the red carpet and with the publicists. It's not like we've got a machine. We're, you know, it's old school. It's I mean, Sal Zance was a good friend of ours, who was a producer, Cuckoo's Nest and Amadeus and many movies. And he was there at all times with the people that made that movie, from the distribution to the events. And that I think puts a bond together, because we both got through that experience. So it's just there. It's like you having a good friend, you having a somebody you don't see for, you know, 2 or 3 years. You could still connect on the moments of your friendship in the past.
Last night I went to see Straight Line Crazy with Ray Fiennes on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And saw him afterwards, and he was so happy to see me, because we have been in the trenches with him on several of the films he's directed, several of the films he's acted in, with various levels of success. And it is it's a bonding exercise. It really is.
We take the movies personally. You know, it's something, when we buy one, we want it to work. It's part of our life.
That does it for today's episode. We'll be back next week with an interview episode, a special from one Julie Miller, our colleague. And then we won't have a roundtable conversation. We're taking a little bit of a break for the holidays. But we'll be back in the new year with so many award shows and everything else to cover. So please, we hope you also get some restful time away in the meantime. You can find us on Twitter at HWD and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield, 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of what it's like to read listener emails goes to David Canfield.
Very sacred experience.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper, with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.